Hi, Luke Groskin here. I produce videos for Science Friday, and we want you to watch them. Did you know that you can subscribe to get our science videos? That's right. Just like the podcast you're listening to, you can subscribe to get a weekly dose of Science Friday on video. Just head over to youtube.com/scifry. That's youtube.com/scifry, and click the subscribe button. It's that easy. Thanks for listening. Now on to the show.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the program, we'll check in on NASA's Dawn mission, which arrived at the dwarf planet Ceres this morning. But first, 100 years ago, the carnage of that great war that chewed up a generation of young soldiers did not halt young scientists from formulating big ideas. In 1915, Albert Einstein published his theory of general relativity. The four-page paper upended the idea of gravity and Isaac Newton's 200-year stranglehold on that school of thought. General relativity is the basis for modern cosmology and astrophysics. How did the theory percolate in Einstein's head? How did it change our view of the world? And will it become obsolete in this quantum multiverse view of the world? David Kaiser is a science historian and professor of physics at MIT. Welcome to Science Friday, David.
Thanks so much, Ira. Glad to be here.
Yeah, you're welcome. Let's talk about the history. How did Einstein come up with this special relativity? He came up with general relativity 10 years after special. What was going on in the meantime in those years?
It was really a remarkable intellectual journey. I mean, I think it was not a solo journey. Einstein, it turns out, had to draw on the help of several friends along the way. But it really was a remarkable kind of intellectual voyage. And the main thing, the place he wound up, where we know he got to, though it wasn't so clear to him when he set out in 1905, but where he got to by 1915 was, as you just mentioned, a really radically different view of how the universe should work or how it could behave. And the biggest change, what he really sort of got to at the end, was this notion that space and time, or their union, what he came to call space-time, could be as wobbly as a trampoline. And that really was a big, big shift from what had come before. As you mentioned, Isaac Newton's physics or even in Einstein's own special theory of relativity from 1905, in those, conceptions, space and time provided a kind of unchanging, rigid platform, a kind of solid stage on which all the other activity of physics could unfold. So you could have apples falling and planets revolving and, ultimately galaxies jostling. But the idea in those older sets of theories of physics was that none of that could impact space and time themselves. They remained this kind of rigid stage, a platform for all the laws of physics to sort of play out. And what Einstein finally got to, not right away, but along this sort of almost 10-year journey, was a very different notion that space-time itself was a player in that action, that space-time could warp or distend or bend in response to where the stuff is, in response to the distribution of matter and energy. And then in turn, the warping of space and time could affect the behavior of all that other stuff so that, planets would move slightly differently if they were moving in a region of space and time that had already been warped by some other large mass. So he gets this notion that there's a dynamical, a changing nature to space-time.
So he actually gives a geometric interpretation of it. In other words, it's something that the geometry of space, the space has a geometrical value to it. It bends, it warps, things like that.
That's exactly right. And again, where he got to by the end of that journey in 1915 was that gravitation was only geometry. Yeah. And that's a really big shift. So in the physics of Newton, as our high school students still learn and we still use all the time to do helpful things like build bridges and even spacecraft, in Newton's physics, we talk about forces. One sort of object of a certain mass will exert an attraction, will tug on some other body with mass. It'll exert a force. And that language, that framework had worked remarkably well, for centuries, as you'd said. But instead, as Einstein gets to this sort of surprising conclusion in 1915, that gravity, the phenomena we associate with gravity, whether it's the fall of an apple or the orbit of, the moon, that has nothing to do with forces. It really is all about geometry. And that's when along the way, part of what took so long, was that unfortunately he had not paid much attention to his geometry classes as a student. So it really came back to bite him that he cut a lot of classes as a kid. So he actually had to work pretty hard just to learn some pretty sophisticated geometry from friends of his along the way.
How readily accepted was it? I mean, we're still testing it out now 100 years later, aren't we?
Well, you know, with hindsight, we can say with extraordinary confidence that it's extremely well. It stood the test of time, you know, exquisitely well. In fact, we're sort of every effort we've made to try to find a weakness in it has been stymied. Ingenious, clever efforts to find some deviation, some change from what Einstein's equations, you know, predict. None of those has borne out in 100 years, which is a great testament to this theory, partly why we're so excited for this centennial year. That's, of course, our view from today. Einstein did not, you know, light up the world right away with this new set of ideas. It was it was couched in very abstract and difficult mathematics, at least for common physicists at the time, what would have been standard for them to know. It relied on a kind of unfamiliar language of a kind of geometry. And it did have all these very strange-sounding concepts embedded in it. So it was a pretty difficult and abstruse kind of theory in its early days.
It took a famous eclipse of 1919, though, to make Einstein famous about that, right?
That's right. No, that changed things, you know, almost overnight. And we should say that Einstein had made predictions that this sort of extreme warping or bending of space and time around an object like the sun, or even now we know even more massive objects like neutron stars or big hulking masses, that the notion that gravity could bend the path of starlight, he actually figured that out on his own even before 1915. And he was very busy writing letters to astronomers in the United States, throughout Germany, saying, will you please test this hypothesis? And Einstein realized it could be tested during a total eclipse, a time when the moon would block out almost all the brightness of the sun from our point of view here on Earth, so that one could see very dim stars whose light had to travel around this warping space warped near the sun. And so Einstein figured that out, and he actually helped to try to get an expedition mounted to test that in 1914. And it turns out he helped raise funds within the German government. He got a colleague of his from Berlin, Erwin Freundlich, to get some assistance and head out. And they had the misfortune of landing in the Crimea, which was right where they expected to see this eclipse, in August of 1914. So suddenly there were Germans in Russia right as war broke out. They were immediately locked up, their equipment confiscated, their experiment was scuttled. So the fact that we get this dramatic, all the more dramatic announcement in 1919 under really different circumstances, a year after war had ended, that really just galvanized Einstein's own celebrity and interest in this theory.
David, thank you for taking time to join us, and a happy 100th anniversary to you.
My pleasure. Thanks, and happy anniversary to you, too.
David Kaiser is a science historian and a professor of physics at MIT. General relativity has generated the idea of black holes, quasars, and even given us the GPS, but Einstein never meant for that theory to be the final answer. What questions are still left? Has general relativity exhausted its usefulness? Will we move beyond the theory in the next 100 years? My next guests are here to walk us through this. Michael Turner is the director of the Kavli Institute for Cosmological Physics at the University of Chicago. Good to see you, Michael.
Good to see you again, Ira.
Nice to have you here in New York. Alex Filipenko is a professor of astronomy at the University of California at Berkeley. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much, Ira.
Michael, what do we still need to know about general relativity?
Well, we've pretty much, after that 100 years, we've pretty much digested it. I want to take off on where David was talking about, that it was really boutique science, boutique theory for the first 50 years, that it was beautiful mathematics and understood by few, but not really necessary for the universe. And in 1963, about 50 years ago, all hell broke loose with the discovery that we live in a universe where general relativity is very important. Black holes, the quasars were discovered, spinning neutron stars, the cosmic microwave background. And it went from boutique science to the essential mathematical tool of any astrophysicist today. And so I guess the big untested piece of general relativity is gravitational waves. So these are the ripples in space-time that are generated when, say, one black hole coalesces with another black hole. And these ripples are very, very tiny, less than the size of an atom. And the U.S. LIGO observatories, the gravitational wave observatories in Louisiana and in Washington state, hope to detect gravitational waves. And that would pretty much close out the standard predictions. Of course, people are probably interested in wormholes after Interstellar and some of the more esoteric pieces. But I think we would be able to say that the primary features of general relativity have been tested and verified.
Alex, and you're working on measuring a supernova to capture something called the Einstein Cross, and there was good news this week about that.
Well, that's right. Yes, Ira, it's very, very exciting. 50 years ago, it was predicted that if a supernova goes off behind a massive galaxy or a cluster of galaxies, the space-time around that galaxy or cluster could be bent so much that it would actually produce several distinct images of the supernova. And the light that, you know, forms these distinct images would travel different amounts of time through space, and so you would see the supernova brighten and fade at slightly different times, and that would actually allow us to, for example, measure the distribution not only of the visible matter in that galaxy, but also of the pervasive dark matter that we think fills the universe. Mm-hmm. And we've found such an object for the first time in 50 years.
And there were pictures of a supernova of actually the lensing effect. You got four instead of one.
Yeah, four instead of one. And in fact, can say that there used to be one. There was one 20 years ago and another one about 50 years ago. And so we missed those. But we've made a prediction based on the models that there should be one, that is another image of this same supernova, sometime in roughly the next 5 years. And so we're going to be taking pictures of that same part of the sky to try to verify that prediction and then use the new observed position to further refine the models of how much dark matter there is and how it's distributed in this galaxy and in the cluster of galaxies in which that galaxy resides.
So that dark matter is one of the new frontiers on this.
Well, that's right. And you know, in fact, this is one of the great exciting things in astrophysics now, this dark matter and also the dark energy that really is the dominant stuff of the universe.
All right, we're going to take a break and we'll come back and talk lots more about Einstein and dark matter, dark energy, with Michael Turner, director of the Kavli Institute for Cosmological Physics at the University of Chicago, Alex Filipenko, professor of astronomy at UC Berkeley. Our number, if you'd like to join us, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In case you just joined us, we're talking about 100 years of Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity. Gosh, time flies. 100 years ago. With my guest, Michael Turner, director of the Kavli Institute for Cosmological Physics at the University of Chicago, Alex Filipenko, professor of astronomy at UC Berkeley. And when we went to the break, we were talking about Einstein never foresaw the use, right, Michael, of the lensing effect for anything. You said it was sort of boutique stuff.
Yeah, and well, first of all, that Einstein cross with the supernova is so cool. Congratulations to Alex and his student.
Thanks, Michael. Isn't it fantastic?
It really
is. That image is so beautiful.
And Einstein, of course, looked at gravitational lensing and made some calculations and said, this will never work. It's way too small. And in 1979, the first gravitational lenses were discovered, twin quasars. And of course, to prove it, you had to show these two images were identical. They weren't just two similar quasars, but they must have been the same object mm-hmm. lensed by gravity. And now here we are today where gravitational lensing is so commonplace. Any of your listeners can go look at the Hubble Deep Field or any of those images from the Hubble. You won't see multiple images, but you'll see the little arcs that are caused by gravitational lensing. Just stare at the picture long enough. And so this going from boutique to being a tool, and now we're going to use it to study the really esoteric things, dark matter and my favorite, dark energy, because by studying the time delays in these systems, mm-hmm. you can figure out how the universe was expanding way back when.
If it's such a good theory, and it's proven itself so well, why are we trying to change it to get it to unite with the world of the quantum? Because quantum is a whole different world, isn't it?
Well, partly because of the fun. We don't want anyone to have the last word on gravity. We don't want Einstein to have the last word on gravity. But what David was saying about how Einstein came to general relativity, he realized Newton and special relativity, those two theories were inconsistent. And that's what led him during that 10-year period to general relativity. And we're in the same dilemma today. that we have general relativity, one of the great intellectual accomplishments of the 20th century, and quantum mechanics, and they're inconsistent. And Einstein realized this, and others have realized it, and so you need a theory that combines the two. The great hope of some people is string theory, mm-hmm. that brings these two together. And then, of course, what's exciting about it is not displacing Einstein, although that's pretty exciting, is all the surprises it will bring. Because as David said, general relativity told us that space-time is dynamical, but it didn't explain where they came from. And yeah. string theory might actually explain where space and time came from.
But it's getting old, string theory, isn't it?
Well, there was another birthday party this year, 30 years of string theory. And so, let's go back and look at general relativity, that the first 50 years were pretty quiet. Yeah. And then all of a sudden there was a breakout. You know, it took the discovery of quasars and other objects that needed general relativity to describe them. So you never know when that's going to happen.
Yeah. And in fact, we can't talk about Einstein without actually hearing a little bit from Einstein. So for many decades, we've been trying to unite general relativity and quantum mechanics. And Einstein himself said that when you have a goal like that, that the scientific method is the tool to get you there.
Whatever this tool in the hand of man will produce depends entirely on the nature of the goals alive in this mankind. Once these goals exist, the scientific method furnishes means to realize them.
Alex, we have the
goal.
That's right. We have the tools.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think an important point is that the nature of science is that we're trying to come up with a progressively better description of what we see, a model for what we call reality. You know, when general relativity was developed, it didn't mean that, you know, planes would have started falling out of the sky had there been a lot of planes up there at the time. You know, Newtonian physics is fine for most everyday phenomena, but general relativity provides a more complete description, and presumably at some point we'll have a quantum theory of gravity that will also provide an ever more complete, ever more, you know, all-encompassing description. But it's always a model for the universe. It's not necessarily what is truth or reality with a capital T or a you know, uppercase R.
But would a quantum theory of gravity have the same geometric design?
No, it probably would be, the exchange of particles, what we would call gravitons. Those are what, in quantum theory, would, in a sense, tell objects that gravity exists, just like in electromagnetism, we have the exchange of photons. And if you just have a stationary proton and an electron on a table, they exchange what are called virtual photons. They're not even real in a sense, but they do mediate this electromagnetic force. And in a similar way, gravitons are the quantum theory equivalent of photons.
Now I see why it's so hard to unite the two. Because because you have a conceptual model of what Einstein said. This is, you know, actually warping space. It's changing the fabric. And you're talking about particles, which, you know.
Yeah, but that's because if you look at the warping of space on ever more microscopic scales, you find that it becomes chaotic and extreme. And that's something that general relativity is not equipped to deal with. And yet it's a clear prediction of quantum theory that on very small scales over very small times, you have these gigantic fluctuations in the energy of space. Indeed, it leads to an infinite or a nearly infinite energy for the vacuum. And we clearly don't live in such a vacuum. So something is going wrong in our understanding of the theory.
And of course, the progress, Einstein wanted to unite them geometrically. And others want to unite them with the forces and particles. And if history is any guide, if you look at the change from Newtonian gravity to general relativity, it doesn't look anything like that. And so that's the most interesting part. There are likely to be surprises. And string theory gives hints of that, where dimensions come and go. So the number of dimensions, 4, is not the total number of dimensions, and dimensions can come and go. And so the new theory is likely to be very different from either the theory that describes the particles at the fundamental level or geometric. And it might allow us to answer big questions like what happened before the Big Bang.
Is it going to require new physics, new things that we just don't even know about, the way things work yet?
I think that's probably the safest bet, that at any given point in time, we think we know a lot. But as the area of our understanding expands, the perimeter of our ignorance gets equally larger. So they're likely to be new things. And it would be nice to predict them beforehand and then go out and discover them. And that's really been the trouble with string theory, is the predictions that can be tested are few and far between.
But who would have predicted dark energy, right? It's popped out just a few years ago.
Well, there were hints. In fact, even Michael Turner in his career said a number of times that certain aspects of the observations would be fixed, in a sense, would be understood if there were something like dark energy. But the evidence before the discovery of the expansion through these observations of distant supernovae, the evidence was always indirect.
Michael?
But it was not it,
you're
the idea was out
here,
there.
And,
yeah,
well, you know, even Einstein had the idea that there, you know, might be a, in a sense, this weird energy pervading the universe.
And that brings us back to how science progresses. So Einstein went from special relativity to general relativity by pure thought and Gedanken experiment.
He thought in his head.
He thought in his head. He did experiments in his head. And often it's the other way around, where startling discoveries and the acceleration of the universe, even though we theorists like to think we anticipated it, that could be the loose thread in general relativity, the thing that doesn't quite fit, that as we understand it better, points us to the next theory of gravity.
So we need somebody doing a little thoughtful experiment again.
We never know if it's going to be a theoretical idea, so string theory purely comes from theory. That's the pure thought again. And on the other hand, every once in a while, people like Alex and make discoveries that the theorists should pay attention to that really gives us the clue as how to go forward.
Years ago when I used to hang out at the Institute for Advanced Study and Einstein's students were still there, they're all gone now, I said, how did Einstein think? And he'd say, you'd ask him a question and he'd say, I'm going to take a walk and I give a little tink. And he would, you know, that's how he would do it. Gentlemen, we've run out of time. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us. The clock is, we know there's no time anymore, so that's gone. Michael Turner is director of the Kavli Institute for Cosmological Physics, University of Chicago. Alex Filipenko is professor of astronomy at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you, gentlemen, and happy anniversary to both
of you. Thanks, Ira.
Very good.
This morning, a journey of 7.5 years came to an end as NASA's Dawn spacecraft left its travel mode and let itself slowly be captured into the orbit around the dwarf planet Ceres. It's the first probe to circle a dwarf planet, but will not be the only one this year. New Horizons is scheduled to make its closest approach to Pluto in July. In the past weeks, as Dawn has made its approach to Ceres, it has sent back some really intriguing photos, including some showing two bright spots on the dwarf planet's surface. What are they? Joining me now to talk about the mission and its goals for the coming month is Mark Raymond. He's Mission Director and Chief Engineer of the Dawn mission based at JPL in Pasadena. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Ira. Thank you. It's nice to be back again.
So how long is the experiment going to be there? How long is Dawn going to be at Ceres?
Well, we're going to be exploring it for about a year, but it's going to be in orbit effectively forever. We're not leaving. We're there to stay.
Wow. Maybe you'll be as lucky as the rovers on Mars, you think?
No, actually, we have high confidence that we will not only complete all of our objectives early next year, but that the spacecraft will not last much longer than that. It's not going to be a long-lived mission there.
I think that's what they said about Curiosity.
Well, when you have me back next year, we can have that discussion. How's that?
It's all about the money in the long run range anyhow. What is the idea here? What is the mission all about?
Well, we're exploring two of the last uncharted worlds in the inner solar system, Ceres, this dwarf planet that we went into orbit around this morning, and we spent 14 months a couple of years ago exploring Vesta, the second most massive object, both of these in the main asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. And we're trying to elucidate their nature because we think they're building blocks of planets. They're some of the the largest objects that were growing to become planets early in the history of the solar system when Jupiter stunted their growth.
So you're going to find some of the remnants even before the planets form in these objects.
That's right. We think these are those remnants. Mm. So, for example, Ceres has a large inventory of ice, may even have some liquid water. We don't know that yet, but it's one of the things we want to investigate. And, of course, I think many people know that there's a big question about how Earth got its water. Well, maybe by exploring Ceres, we'll learn more about that.
Mm-hmm. When it was discovered back in 1801, it was considered one of the major planets, right? And then went through a series of demotions that only Pluto could appreciate.
That's right. Well, it has had a sort of planetary identity crisis. It was discovered in 1801, and the astronomers at the time had suspected there was a planet between Mars and Jupiter because they were aware of that large gap. Mm-hmm. And so when Ceres was discovered, it initially was thought to be the missing planet, and so it was called a planet. Mm-hmm. And in the next few years, a few more objects were discovered there. And in fact, if we'd been having this conversation 200 years ago, people might have counted Ceres as one of the planets. It was taught that way in schools, even.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Mark Raymond, Mission Director and Chief Engineer of the Dawn Mission. Let's talk about what's also interesting is the engine that's powering Dawn. It's a new kind of engine, an ion drive, and that means that you circle into the planet, into Ceres in a different way than we've normally thought about. Isn't that true?
That's exactly right. This ion propulsion I first heard of in a Star Trek episode when Mr. Spock talked about it. And many people maybe know it from the Star Wars TIE fighters, T-I-E, stood for twin ion engine. But Dawn has three ion engines, so we do the Star Wars TIE fighters one better. And the ion engine is 10 times more efficient than conventional chemical propulsion. So this allows us to undertake missions that are just would be impossible without it. So Dawn would be not just difficult, but a truly impossible mission with conventional technology. And it's the first spacecraft ever to orbit two extraterrestrial destinations. Mm-hmm. But although the engine is efficient, it's also very gentle. And that's why the approach into Ceres orbit is very different. So you're used to thinking of a spacecraft coming screaming up at high velocity, you know, and it executes this bone-rattling, whiplash-inducing burn into orbit. But Dawn just very, very gently, gradually, elegantly slips into orbit, maneuvering in a complex route that would be the envy of any Cracker Jack spaceship pilot.
Yeah, I actually tweeted a little video of that for people want to look at it because it is quite different. It's sort of like parking your car a little bit. It's a little bit, it's like parallel parking there at one stage.
That's right. We can constantly adjust the trajectory, so we gradually ease in and maneuver around as much as we need to.
Well, how will you know if this is a successful mission? What are you trying to come back with?
Well, what we really want to do is discover the nature of Ceres. So it's not that we have to prove that it's one way or the other, and it's not that we have to answer anything about it other than what is the world made of? How does it work? What's the geology, the geophysics? And so the success of the mission is, have we uncovered the nature of what right now is the largest body between the Sun and Pluto that has not yet been explored?
Mm-hmm. And it's part of a bunch of other stuff there, too.
It is. Well, it's in the main asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. But of the millions, literally millions upon millions of objects there, Ceres is not only the largest, but it has about 30% of the mass of the entire main asteroid belt. It's a big place.
Mm-hmm. Is anything else like it around there?
Nothing else like it around there. Its mm-hmm. closest relatives are perhaps the icy moons of Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus, the icy moons of the outer solar system. So why this object is as close to the sun as it is, we don't know right now.
Hmm. Well, can you stay with us? Because we're going to have to take a break, but I know there are folks that have questions to ask of you.
Sure.
You say that it's going to orbit forever, possibly, and it's never going to crash into the planet, run out of orbital momentum?
Well, we don't expect it to, at least for many, many decades. And the reason for that is because, as we discussed, Ceres may have liquid water.
We'll finish the answer on the other side of the music.
Okay.
Stay with us. Talking with Mark Raymond, Mission Director, Chief Engineer of the Dawn Mission. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have hopefully some of your questions. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking about the Dawn Mission with my guest Mark Raymond, Chief Engineer and Mission Director. Dawn is at Ceres. I got one more question because I couldn't let you go without asking you about these mysterious white spots that were photographed on.
They're very intriguing, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Are just these sort of glowing beacons shining out from the uncharted landscape ahead. And the answer to your question of what they are is we don't know. Again, it makes you want to send a spacecraft there to find out. We haven't seen something like this elsewhere in the solar system. Ceres mostly has a dark surface. It reflects only less than 10% of the light that impinges on it. And yet, standing out from a few places, in particular one crater, are these two bright reflective areas. And we don't know why. And our pictures yet aren't of high enough resolution. That is, the bright spots are smaller than one pixel. And so we need to get in closer before we can determine what their nature is.
Well, you certainly have the time to do that now, don't you?
We do. And over the course of the mission, we will spiral closer and closer and closer. By the end of this year, we'll have pictures 800 times better than what we had at the beginning of the year, and still more than 100 times better than the ones we have now.
Well, Mark, when you get him back from the drugstore, we'll have you on.
I'll look forward to that.
It's quite interesting. Mark Raymond is Mission Director and Chief Engineer of the Dawn Mission based at JPL. Thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you, Ira. I appreciate your interest.
How much health care is too much health care? Up to you, of course, and your insurance company. But my next guest writes in his new book, Less Medicine, More Health, the more CT scans you get, the more biopsies and genetic tests, the higher the odds that doctors will discover something abnormal about you. After all, he says, the natural part of being human is abnormality. And these days, rest assured, there's a pharmaceutical or a surgical fix for your abnormality, a fix that may ultimately harm you more than the abhorrent condition itself. The cure might be worse than the disease, he says. But how do you strike a balance between too much medical care and too little? Well, that's what my guest, Dr. H. Gibble Welch, writes about in Less Medicine, More Health, Seven Assumptions That Drive Too Much Medical Care. He's also a professor at Dartmouth Medical School in New Hampshire. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you for having me, Ira.
You've basically boiled out, as you say in the title, there are seven assumptions in your book. And one of those is that it's always better to fix the problem, isn't it? That's a bad assumption. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, it always seems to make sense, right?
Yeah.
Of course, fix the problem. But, you know, sometimes that's not true. Often it's better to manage the problem of heart disease with a healthy diet and active lifestyle, maybe a few good medications, than it is to try to fix the problem of heart disease by inserting wires, blowing up balloons, and placing stents. And there's a number of places where sometimes exactly the right thing to do in medical care is to manage problems, not to try to correct them.
What's the difference between fixing it and managing?
Well, fixing it, you know, implies some carpentry work, some mechanical work, often surgery or some invasive procedure, and managing it may involve simply lifestyle choices, diet, and physical therapy, that kind of thing.
And you have the same outcome then, as you manage.
And you can avoid a lot of risk. I mean, one of the issues, of course, is to try. You know, one of the prescriptions, I think, when it comes to the question of fixing versus managing problems, is simply to ask about options. And start slow. You know, you have various options. Start slow and see what works for you. Don't always assume that the most aggressive option is the right way to go.
Oh, 'cause it could have unintended consequences.
Absolutely right. Everything we do in healthcare has some unintended consequences, and some things more than others. Mm-hmm. And so you want to you want to start slow.
Something we talk a lot about on Science Friday is early detection. And you make the case that detecting cancer early and doing something about it isn't always the best solution for patients.
That's right. And of course, the idea, the assumption being that sooner is always better is, you know, pretty hardwired in our culture, and particularly for a feared disease like cancer. But our understanding of cancer is changing. We're recognizing it's extremely diverse set of diseases. And some people have likened the diversity in cancer to a barnyard pen of animals. And the animals are birds, the rabbits, and the turtles. And the idea of early detection is try to fence these animals in. Well, you can't fence the bird in. The birds are already gone, and these represent the fastest, the most aggressive cancers, the cancers that have already spread by the time they're detectable. There, the question is, can we treat them? The rabbits are hopping around. If you build enough fences, you can catch them, and that's where screening will arguably have its best effect. But then there are the turtles, and they're the cancers that aren't going anywhere anyway. And those are the indolent cancers. They meet the pathologic definition of cancer, but they actually are never going to bother the patient. And the problem is we don't know which is which, so we treat them. And none of us want to be treated for a cancer that isn't going anywhere. And it turns out their screening is very good at finding turtles. About a third of adults have small thyroid cancers that have nothing to do with their future life expectancy. Upwards of a third of women will have small breast cancers in their 40s, and over half of men age 60 plus will have small prostate cancer. So the problem with early detection is it's been a recipe for finding a lot of small stuff, and it becomes an approach that can needlessly turn people into patients. And we're going to have a lot more options to look for early forms of disease, and I think all the public needs to be a little cautious about those efforts.
But they should be. There are some people who should be screened.
Absolutely. The screening will make most sense in those people at the highest risk for developing the disease. And more doctors recognize this problem and are thinking more about risk-based screening. But all screening has some harms. It leads some people to be treated unnecessarily, leaves others to worry unnecessarily. And the effects of screening are actually quite small, even in terms of helping people.
We hear a lot about Fitbits, fuel bands, smartphone apps that monitor your heart rate and so on. This seems to be the future, but you're telling us to be careful about all
yeah,
this stuff.
Yeah, I certainly am. I mean, it seems like the value of information has become almost a central tenet of the 21st century. But it is a tenet that confuses data with useful knowledge. And there are a lot of data out there. I mean, it's very easy for us to measure things. There are millions bits of structural pixels that we could get about various parts of your body and imaging anatomically. There are all sorts of chemical tests we can do and biochemical tests. There are 3 billion data points in your genome. But we're going to have to really be careful because all that data has a lot of false alarms. A lot of it is noise. Even the geneticists are talking about thus variants of unknown significance. And this can be a recipe for sort of a haphazard process that scares people and leads doctors to do sort of haphazard things. And I think we need to get back to some very basic questions about, you know, how are you feeling? How are you actually doing? How do you actually function? And be wary about, you know, widespread collection of data on individuals and trying to make some predictions about the future.
Is that because we're going to be overwhelmed with so much information?
Well, I think it's overwhelmed with data. That's the problem. And of course, more and more physicians are experiencing that every day in the clinical setting, and sometimes data can confuse physicians. It can actually distract them from the patients that from what's actually bothering you.
Mm-hmm. What's your take on genome scanning? You know, valuable tool, unnecessary test.
Well, I think whole genome scanning is an absurd test. We may want to be targetedly testing for targeted genes, those or other mutations that are highly penetrant, that are highly likely to predict clinical disease. But most genetic information is nothing like that. It's very weakly predictive, if predictive at all.
Talking with Dr. H. Gilbert Welch, Less Medicine, More Health, Seven Assumptions That Drive Too Much Medical Care is his book. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Matt in Hartford. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Ira. I'd just like to say that this whole assumption that too much medicine could be a bad thing could also be applied to mental health care. For example, I was diagnosed with ADHD at a very young age, but it wasn't until I was older that I was actually prescribed medicine for it. And in turn, that really impacted my anxiety and led to more issues. And I think if you look at the medication rate among younger children for issues like ADHD or anxiety, and for young school children, I think you can say the same about mental health care.
Absolutely right. That there's been explosive growth of the use of pharmaceuticals in children, and a lot of those have been for ADHD. And I think this is one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, is so the general public had a little bit more sense of the nuances of medical care. There was a recent survey of primary care practitioners, and nearly one half said their patients received too much care. And I think it's important for people to know that medical care can do a lot of good in selected settings, but it can also do harm in others. And I believe we're over-medicating our children right now. There's no question.
Are we over-surgerying them also by operating when it may not be necessary?
I think there are certainly cases where we are. I mean, probably one of the best cases is the use of back surgery for back pain. It's a place where we really have to be careful that we're not doing too many operations, because back surgery has the unfortunate side effect of turning acute back pain into chronic back pain in many patients. So I think everybody needs to understand that, you know, just because something may be good for some people doesn't mean it's going to be good for everybody, and that this is a nuanced situation where more medical care isn't going to be in everybody's interest. And what you're really looking for in a doctor is a considered professional that isn't always doing something, but is someone who's really has your best interests in mind, mm-hmm. and understands that you understand there's a balance between no medical care and having medical care for everything under the sun.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. In case you're just joining us, we're talking to Dr. H. Gilbert Welch, author of Less Medicine, More Health. You know, one of the things that struck a chord, there are a lot of things that struck a chord in your book with me, and that is the value, and it seems to be a trend a little bit in medicine now, of waiting.
Yeah.
You get bad news, but wait. Don't just jump right in.
Yeah, I think that's a very good issue to talk about. In some ways, time is a piece of diagnostic information. It's more than data. It has some real value. The effect of what's happening over time gives us some dynamic information. What direction are you going? Are you able to heal on your own? Are things getting better or are things getting worse? And that suggests that maybe we do need to intervene. When we're talking about cancer, early cancers, and in fact this is happening now as part of lung cancer screening, the doctors aren't reacting to the small cancers. They're instead trying to see which way are these cancers going. Are they growing, or are they staying the same size, or are they in fact going away?
Mm-hmm. The last assumption that you write about in your book is death, that healthcare is, quote, all about avoiding death. You're saying it's not.
Yeah, well, I want to be clear. This is value judgment territory, and everybody needs to think about these issues on their own. And this is by far the most personal chapter in the book. But it is the way we think as doctors. We're all about, you know, how much can we lengthen life? How much can we prolong life? And I think more and more of the general public and doctors themselves are saying, well, it's about what kind of life and how are we going to approach life. And if it's really all about avoiding death, you begin to ask yourself, is that really true? I mean, why would we ever climb mountains? Why would we ever swim in the ocean? And full disclosure, I'm someone who just loves water. I love being in water. But I look at CDC data. We have 3,000 deaths a year related to swimming. Half of those are in natural bodies of water. Should we close access to all our beaches? I don't think so, because, you know, a strategy all about avoiding death has a really huge downside. And I think that downside is that a fixation on preventing death, it really diminishes our life. And I think we all need to really think about what kind of life we want to live. And ironically, I think that the healthiest lives occur in those people who aren't too focused on their health.
Well, then what should we focus on?
You should focus on living a good life, enjoying it, finding purpose, taking care of yourself for sure, getting a healthy diet, moving, but also your social relationships. All that stuff is important to your health.
And don't think about getting that yearly checkup at the doctor all the time.
Yeah, don't think about that yearly checkup to the doctor.
Wait till you have a real problem.
Have a real problem. You may, as you get older and you develop some chronic problems, you'll want to have a relationship with a doctor. You'll want a doctor who can advise you and help shepherd you through the system. But the idea of an annual head-to-toe physical, it creates more problems than it solves.
And there you have it. My guest has been Dr. H. Gilbert Welch. He's author of Less Medicine, More Health, 7 Assumptions That Drive Too Much Medical Care. He's professor at Dartmouth Medical School in New York. It's a great read, Dr. Welch. It makes you think about the healthcare system and your own physician.
Yes.
Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Have a great weekend. That's about all the time we have for this hour. Charles Berquist is our director, senior producer. Christopher Intagliata, Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer, Annie Minoff. Lou Groskin is our video producer. Our production assistant, Becky Fogel. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And if you missed any part of the program, you'd like to hear it again, point your tablet or your smartphone to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can join our mailing list. Tonight, our podcast will be ready for you in case you want to hear it again on our podcast. It's the whole show at once on our podcast, but you can download our apps and get the show in segments on there if you'd like to check it out on our apps also. And if you like us on Facebook, and we continue a week-long discussion on Twitter at SciFry. And you can write us at Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. I'm Ira Flato in New York.